Hey everyone. So you've probably noticed that we usually like to censor our episodes with a silly little bleep whenever we swear, but we're not going to be doing that in today's episode. And the reason for that is that we have a very frank discussion about the censorship of certain words in the context of art and creativity, and also in the context of reclaiming certain words for your own power. And because of that, I felt it was more appropriate to leave them in instead of bleeping them out. So this is a warning that you're going to be hearing some words that have been and still are considered slurs. We will be saying the F gay slur, some other slurs that are maybe not quite as offensive in some people's opinions towards gay people, and we will also be referencing the N word. We're not going to say it, but it is included in the name of some of our artist Julius Eastman's works. So, yeah, just again, we're not going to be bleeping out any words this episode, so if you're sensitive to harsh language, then maybe let someone else listen to it and give you a summary. Otherwise, if you don't mind, please enjoy our episode and happy Pride Month.
If you want to find out about classical queers, then you're in the right place with Alice and Jaheed.
Yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Classical Queeros, the show where we aim to de-straighten classical music with queer composers, especially composers of color, and lots of glitter, but mostly composers.
I love glitter.
Me too. I love that it gets everywhere.
Yeah.
When I was like just starting to be able to go out and experience nightlife, I like got like glitter perfume from like Bath and Body Works, and 18-year-old me was obsessed, and it got all over my clothes and my car.
Oh my god. I love glitter. I've had many dresses that were glittery, and like I see it, like I scan the dresses in the rack at the store, and then I see the one with glitter, and I'm like, that's the one I want. I used to have these really sparkly heels too that I liked a lot. Oh, I just love glitter.
Ooh,
I love
me too.
Yeah, it makes me feel so good. I'm like a little princess.
Yeah, it's like, you know, you want to like move in the light and then
yeah,
just like let it just like shine off of you.
Yeah.
Like a giant disco ball.
Yeah. Oh my god, also it's Pride Month this month.
It's Pride Month. Okay, first of all, my introduction was I'm Shahid Osuna, he, him, his, and happy Pride.
Aww.
So that was my
I ruined it.
I
Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. I actually wanted to talk about the Pride flag that we use in our banner. Which is it has a rainbow, but it also has black and brown. And so for those who don't know, a little bit of like Pride Month flag history. Those colors were added by a black queer woman named Amber Hikes, and it was specifically to remind the community about inclusivity, because gay history was often whitewashed, as we know from this entire podcast, this entire premise of our podcast. So I've just like, I've had, I've heard of gay cis men who were like, why do we need this? Like, obviously there's no reason you would like understand firsthand, because you wouldn't experience this like whitewashing or like exclusion from the community. But it is true that our community is very focused on Eurocentric beauty standards, and there's a lot of racism that's both blatant and internalized, and just like, it's not good. So just remember, if you see this flag with these colors, remember that it came from a black queer woman and remember what it represents.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I actually didn't know. I knew that the flag, that version of the flag with the black and brown bars added to it, I knew that that was like specifically including people of color, specifically black and brown people, because those were the people who led the Pride movement, or I guess not Pride movement, but like gay rights movement in the 60s with Stonewall and all that. Like that, all of that, all of that was led by like black trans women. And I know that like I, as a lesbian today living with my girlfriend, would not be able to do this happily and safely without those black women, without those women of color, all these trans women who were phenomenal trailblazers like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera. But I didn't know specifically that this flag was made by a Black queer woman. Do you know how recent that was?
Very recent.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to say the past couple of years.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
I don't remember exactly what year. Don't quote me on this, but I think it was for Philadelphia at first that adopted.
Oh.
They hired an agency, which she was, don't quote me on this again, I think this executive director of this agency and designed this flag for them. And, you know, she made the flag and it was first rose there where she was there and watched it go up, and it was just like,
oh, that's awesome.
Moment.
That must have felt so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I feel like every single like institution, whether it is like a physical place or like a community, a career field, all of them is like, oh, there's these really nice things about it. Like the queer community, the gay community is like, oh, it's great because gay people are, you know, what's the word? Straight people don't like us. And so we escape and we have our own community. But then within that community, the white gays are like, oh, I don't talk to people who aren't white. And it's just like, or like gay people and straight people will just trash on bisexual people. Like, you know, there's just a bunch of like hate thrown around all over the place. And I feel like it's like that in so many other fields I found, like classical music, for example. Where it's like music is this beautiful thing that can connect people. And yet at the same time, there's these awful aspects of it where we're like, you know what? Recently, I saw a Facebook post by a white man who was a composer, and he had this picture of a score, I think it was a piano score for something, that was just, like, marked all up in pencil, like, a lot, and he was, like, what does he call it? The notation is sanctimonious, and notating on it like this is sacrilegious and is bad. And I was like, that is a hot take. Like, he was like, like, the notation is art, and to write on the art like this is to damage it. It's like vandalism.
Wow.
And there were so many comments that were like, finally someone said it. And I'm like, why are you taking such a hot take on something that like
that's a weird hill to die on.
I know. I've always believed, and I tell this to all my students, that like writing on your music only means that you're trying to pay attention. Like, the more you write on your music doesn't mean you're a bad musician. It means you're a good musician because you're trying your best, you know? I write all over my music. And the fact that like this one white man was like, and he's like a fairly liberal leaning like old man, but I don't know. And my point being, we have all these institutions that are like, there are good things, but then there's these bad things. So I feel like I realized lately that my job as a person is to be a spy and infiltrate these institutions and then infuse them secretly with joy and acceptance. That's my job.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I love that.
Thank
I really love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should put that, like, we need to put that somewhere.
Ooh.
Quote those exact words. Do you have that, like, memorized, or was that just like a summation of your ideas? That was beautifully worded.
Oh, thank you. I just made that up right now, basically. I mean, I'd said the idea before, but wow. Oh my god, should I do impromptu speeches all the time?
Yes, impromptu speech. Impromptu speech.
Okay.
I'm gonna be cheering you on, like we're gonna have like a game night and I'd be like, impromptu speech.
I'm like, dearly beloved, we are gathered here today.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, so Pride Month. Happy Pride, everybody.
Happy Pride. Did you do your intro? I already forgot.
Oh no. My name is Alice Park. My pronouns are she, her, hers. And I just got a job at a climbing gym because I am an athlete now, I guess. Yeah, that's my intro. And
that's
it's
so cool.
Yeah, and it's kind of related to Pride because I am not the only queer person there, which is super cool. My manager is actually bi. He's a bi man, which is great. We don't have enough of those who are out and, like, accepted of themselves and all that. So we've like talked about it, and it's great. And I plan to be a spy at this gym as well, and infiltrate them with my acceptance, and like just be like, hey guys, we just, the only rules are safety and fun. Like, we don't need to worry about anything else. Just acceptance and being nice to each other, you know. So that's what I'm gonna do. I'm very excited about it.
I love that.
Yeah, I get to like help little kids climb and stuff, and yeah.
So cute.
Yeah, I already got to recently, like last night, I was belaying a child. So for you podcast listeners who don't know what belaying is, when you rock climb, you're attached to a rope, typically, and the rope is attached to you, and then it goes all the way up to the top. It's connected to something at the top, and it comes all the way back down, and there's a person at the bottom who's attached to the other end of the rope who's holding onto it with, like, special devices to make sure that if you let go, you're not going to fall to the ground. You're just going to hang in the air. So I was belaying some children who were, like, maybe 5. I don't know. They were pretty small.
Whoa.
Yeah. And so the whole process for when you belay, I have to, like, take extra rope as they go up higher. But I ended up doing it, like, too much to where I was just lifting the child, like, further up the wall. I didn't even feel it because they don't weigh anything. So I'm going to have to practice that. But it's very fun. They're very cute. Children as climbers are wild because they weigh nothing. So it's, like, you know when, like, we as adult people have to do a pull-up and you're like, oh, God, this is the worst thing ever, because you have to pull your entire body weight up by your arms.
Uh-huh.
You know, but children weigh 10 pounds. And so when they have to pull themselves up, it's like, oh, that's so easy. It's like lifting paper. Children are just always better climbers than everybody else. And it's nice and humbling, you know? Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. I would be so afraid as a 5-year-old to be like, I still am. I'm like 24 years old and I would still be afraid to rock.
It's okay. It's so safe. And like the goal, listen, I told this to a child yesterday because she got nervous at one point. I was like, the goal of climbing isn't to get to the top, it's to just push yourself to where if you do something but you're scared and then you do it anyway, then like that's it. If you try, that's all it's,
that's
about.
Awesome.
Yeah. And like I didn't say that just to make her feel better. I said that because I really truly believe it. Sometimes I have these days where I'm scared and I'm just like, I don't want to do it, and then I take one more step and I'm like, I'm done, but I took the step, you know.
Yeah. And you made progress.
Yeah.
And that's what counts.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah. This is a climbing podcast now.
This is a climbing podcast.
Classical climbers.
And one of the hosts does not climb.
It's just an hour of me being like, this is this climbing term. And also, I did this yesterday.
I would subscribe and listen to every single second of every episode.
Even though you're in it?
Even though I already do that for our podcast.
Oh my God, me too. Wow. Anyway, shall we get on with our show? Probably.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So I am so excited to talk to you today about Julius Eastman.
Dun, da, da.
Who is... Da-da-da! Yeah. He was an unapologetically Black and queer experimental and proto-minimalist composer, dancer, choreographer, actor, singer, pianist, and an active resistance to the whiteness which permeated the stage of new music.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I'm loving learning about him.
Uh-huh.
And I'm so excited to teach you, but first, it's time for our segment, What Do You Say Gay?
Yay!
Alice.
Okay, I'm ready.
If you could be reborn in a past decade, which one would you pick and why?
Ooh, reborn into a past decade. That's okay. That's a tough question because typically questions of like, if you could be, you know, if you could have lived in a different time period, what would it be? Usually I say I would choose to stay where I am because I am gay, biracial, asthmatic, and I have poor eyesight, and I wouldn't survive any time else.
Do you wonder why I worded it that specific way?
You knew.
I knew. Yeah, I was like, I need to make you pick something else.
Okay, but ah! Sorry. Classical queer is unhinged. But okay, let's pretend that, like, I don't have to worry about dying upon childbirth, like my own birth. Let's see. I guess I would choose, I think I would choose, oh gosh, I don't know. I love the 80s and 90s. Like, the whole aesthetic is just, like, I've talked about how I think that 80s music is the Baroque music of pop, and I could talk about that for a long time. And I love the 80s. I love the big hair. Listen, so Baroque music is dramatic. It is, each singular work of music was based off of one mood, one emotion, one feeling. And there were lots of embellishments, often harpsichord, and people had big hair and frilly sleeves. And if you look at 80s pop music, well, people had big hair and frilly sleeves, and the music is dramatic, and there's lots of, like, harpsichord sounds sometimes, too. And I firmly believe that 80s music is Baroque, and that's just the way that it is. You don't need a fugue for it to be Baroque. It doesn't have to be Bach. It's just 80s. So I'm just going to go with the 80s for the neo-Baroque. Yeah.
You know, as soon as you said harpsichord and pop music, I heard the first, like, couple of notes of Take On Me.
Oh, my God. Like, oh, yeah. I mean, like, a synthesizer, let's be real, it's closer to a harpsichord than a piano. Just in tone, in timbre, right? So,
yeah.
Truly, the 80s is Baroque. I've said this for years, and I will continue to say it. So my answer, I would be reborn into the 80s, where I could have big poofy hair, and I could get a microwave for the first time, and I could listen to Madonna, and Wham. Wait, was Wham the 80s or the 90s? Oh gosh, I'm a fake fan. Who else was in the 80s? Suddenly I don't remember. anyway, I'll be born in the 80s. That's what I want.
I love that.
Thank you. What about you?
So, oh my God. So we're so similar, except okay, hold on. My laptop is about to die.
Oh no.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, decade I was going to be born in. I have the exact same answer as you, except I chose the 70s so that by the time I'm like in my teens, I'd be in the 80s. And then when I'm in my early 20s, I'm in the early 90s. So, like, if I was born exactly beautiful in 1970, then, like, mm-hmm. because, like, exactly the same thing that you were saying, like, 80s and 90s, you get, like, also the club kids scene in the 90s in the nightlife, which is so cool to me, like, just, like, gender-bending fashion and just, like, being this, like, amazing... Uh-huh. I don't know, like, influence. Spice Girls, obviously, like, the world of girl power.
Oh my God, obviously.
Yeah. I get to see Crazy Madonna, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Like, all of that stuff is just, like, amazing. I was just reading an article about somebody who did grow up, like, in the 80s and 90s and how, like, the feminist movement before that was, like, all about, like, equal rights, and then how in the 80s and 90s the feminist movement kind of moved towards, like, not so much, like, things that were trivial, but, like, girl power, and was seen as, like, a little bit different. And so girls, there was something that she was saying, how, like, I was taking for granted what, or my mother thought I was taking for granted, but it was just, like, a totally different time. Like, everything they had worked for was so different than the girls growing up in the 80s and 90s. Women growing up in 80s and 90s did than, you know, 60s, 70s women.
Wow.
Totally different.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So this, like, glam girl power, like, aesthetic that we get in the 80s and 90s. I mean, I love it. I don't think it's trivial at all in any way. I think it's so awesome. Like, I think, why not be both? Like, you can be serious and glam, and you don't even have to be serious. Like, just be kick ass. Like, it doesn't matter. So
yeah.
I especially love that. So the reason I ask that is kind of an interesting idea to put in our heads, because Stonewall, Pride, as we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Julie, oh my God, sorry. Sorry, that was so bad.
Oh my God, that was fabulous.
Anyways.
Okay.
Julius Eastman was living in New York in his late 20s when Stonewall happened. So just like kind of to get an idea of, it's like so coincidental that it's Pride Month and we're talking about this. But yeah, this composer was queer and Black and lived in New York during Stonewall, which is like pretty tremendous. Yeah, so I guess without further ado, in that little segue, we're going to go into the life of Julius Eastman. But first, we should probably take a commercial break.
Commercial break!
If you want to find out about classical queers.
Alice.
Shaheed.
Do you remember Jane Schaefer?
Is that the five-paragraph essay lady? Topic sentence, concrete detail, commentary, etc.?
Yeah, what was up with that?
I don't know, but it definitely doesn't help with writing in the real world.
Yeah, well, you know what could help with writing in the real world?
Ooh, tell me!
Honeybee Writing Coach.
Honeybee Writing Coach?
Yeah, it's a queer-owned business that helps people write all sorts of things.
Like college essays?
Yep.
What about resumes?
Oh, yeah.
Cover letters?
Mm-hmm.
Website content?
That too.
School applications?
Uh-huh.
Raise requests?
Yeah, literally anything you can think of.
What about writing help for kids?
Of course.
Can I learn how to use my voice to get where I want to go in life? And empower myself and others? And make a difference in the world around me?
Literally all of the above.
Wow! Where can we find this magical writing coach?
Just go to honeybeewritingcoach.com.
Do you mean HoneyBeeWritingCoach.com?
Yeah, Honeybee Writing Coach. Write to learn, write to succeed, and write to lead.
So, I don't know if you guys know this, but I have a cat. Her name is Rosie. She's right here next to me. Rosie, say hi. Okay, maybe next time. Anyway, Rosie, like most good cats, has to pee and poop on occasion. And most of these cats will do this in litter if they live in a house. So, we recently switched to my new favorite litter of all time. It's called Pretty Litter. It's great. I like it a lot. Reason number one I like it is not dusty. So when you pour it into the box and when it just exists there all the time, it's not floating up into the air making me cough and sneeze and stuff. It's really good for my lungs and it's really good for Rosie's lungs. Number two, the litter will change color if your cat is sick with something. So if the pee in the litter is yellow, then you're fine. If it's like red or blue, then that's not normal. And you know that your cat is sick, and that's good, because cats like to pretend that they're not sick all the time. But your litter will tell you if they're lying. And then finally, this litter is great because, well, actually, not finally. Anyway, this litter is great because it's not clumping. So it's so easy to scoop. Like when we changed to this litter, the whole like scooping process just got so easy. The bag was no longer filled with clumps of litter. It's just poop. And then the pee is dried and it's gone forever. And it's great. And it's just so nice because you can sign up for a subscription service to get it delivered to your house. 3 bags at a time. Every 3 months, you just use 1 bag a month, and that's all you need to do. It's super easy. It's super great. I love this litter. So if you want to get yourself some really good litter for yourself and also support Classical Queeros in a tiny, tiny way, you can go ahead and go to prettylitter.sjv.io/classicalqueeros. One more time. That is prettylitter.sjv.io/classicalqueeros. And you can get yourself some pretty litter and also get us like $9. I'll be totally transparent. So get yourself pretty litter today for your cat or also for someone else's cat. Nothing matters. I love you all and I love Rosie.
Then you're in the right place with Alice and Jaheed.
Yay.
All right. So Julius Dunbar Eastman Jr. was born on October 27th, 1940 in Manhattan. His mother knew that he was special. She recalled that when he was at a young age, he would like memorize and repeat the words of like bedtime stories that she told him.
Oh my God.
Which is like kind of crazy.
Uh-huh. You know, actually I did the same thing when I was a kid. Like, you know, the kid story, brown bear, what do you see?
I don't, but...
Oh, it's just, like, this cute little Eric Carle story, and when I was, like, three, my parents were like, oh my God, Alice knows how to read, because I would, like, read the story back to them, but no, I just remembered, because it was, like, a very simple poem, and it all, like, led into each other, you know, so it, like, makes sense, but, yeah, they're like, oh my God, you can read, but I couldn't, I just memorized this whole story.
Repeating the words, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, he was doing that, he's also, his personality was, like, super... I guess bold, even at a really young age. So here's a funny quote. He would not compromise. If I told him to behave and sit down, he would stand rigidly erect like a board with his fist clenched, and you would have to kill him and break his bones to make him sit down.
Oh my God.
He never changed.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he was a fighter.
Wow, we love that.
And he was kind of like a trickster, I guess, like a little bit of a, yeah, which we'll see later, like even like after his death, like in his legacy, like some trickster sort of stuff. That
whoa.
Happens.
Okay.
Another quirky thing that in his personality was he saw possessions as pretty trivial. Had no boundaries for them. This is something also another thing foreshadowing that I'll talk about later.
Oh, spicy.
So there's a story of him as like a little kid taking a walk with his mom, and there's this like guy who is freezing and did not have a coat, and he just like took off his coat and gave it to him and just like walked away.
Wow.
So yeah, he like always was like, but also the inverse where he would like use other people's things
well,
without asking.
Okay.
Yeah, and he would always just be like, oh my gosh, like it's just it's stuff, you know. And he also like, I guess this is later in adulthood, because when he was a child he was pretty shy, but he had like no filter. And so there's like multiple accounts of like people taking him with like family or like around little children, and he's just like fuck, or like just like cusses, like no filter.
Oh my God.
I think there was one of like he was like at Christmas with someone, and like they were opening presents, and like he gave him Eastman gave the guy like a porn magazine. And he was like, oh, yeah, you can open it here, even though
oh, my
was,
God.
Like,
wow.
So, yeah. But in the beginning, he was, as a kid, he was shy. Uh-huh. So that happens later.
Wow. So was it like, do you think it was like a gradual change? Or do you think one day he woke up, he's like, I'm just going to live my life now?
I'm sure it was gradual. I think that once, I don't want to like. Assume or like place my what you know I don't want to like project or anything but I'm assuming that as soon as he started really composing the music and finding stuff that he was more spiritually connected to, because he was really spiritual, that maybe he started to come out of his shell a little bit more, maybe when he started meeting other black artists, because as you will learn, where he grew up in Ithaca, there is like a very small black population. So to be like a black queer man like in new music, like super white, like so I'm sure that that had a lot to do with it as well, but who knows. I mean, I can't say for sure. That's my prediction.
I love it. Shaheed is a meteorologist.
Meteorologist. Yeah. So okay, so they moved to Syracuse in the early 40s. His dad enlisted and his mom worked at General Electric. And in 1947, so they had a little brother, he had a little brother named Jerry. And so in 1947, they moved to Ithaca. Eastman was super attached to his mom, and his relationship with his dad was strained, and they actually divorced. His dad didn't want kids, so he, like, left them. So the mother was basically taking care of Jerry and Julius. Wow. Yeah. So he... Let's see, the mom was a pianist. Mm-hmm. Around 10 years old, they went to go visit his grandma in New York. Mm-hmm. And his mom, they were, like, walking, and they walked past a music store, and she was like, oh, I used to get stuff from there. And he was like, oh, I want to get something. So they left with, like, a book, a little piano book, which had Für Elise in it, like a Beethoven. Mm-hmm. And he, like, learned it at the piano that they had in Ithaca, even though he only had, like, general music stuff in, like, elementary school. Like, he wasn't trained or anything, but he just, like, was able to do it.
Wow. Okay.
So he had, like, this natural talent.
Uh-huh. That's awesome.
He also started singing in school, and he was, like, being paid to sing in a church. He was at the Glee Club, and even though he was, like, shy, and he was, like, pretty small in stature, mm-hmm. He had, like, a booming bass baritone voice by the time he was, like, 14.
Wow.
did you know anyone that was, like, I had someone in high school who was, like, also, like, small in stature, but he was, like, had the lowest voice of, like, anyone.
I don't think I knew anybody like that in high school, but I remember somebody at CESA, and he had this, like, beautiful, like, low tenor. Not even low tenor. I think he was a baritone, actually. But he was so small, and he looked like a teddy bear, but he was had this, like, beautiful low voice.
Yeah.
I want a beautiful low voice.
Me too.
Do I have a beautiful low
Maybe the
voice?
Microphone.
Yes. Yes,
maybe
I do.
The microphone will help me. Our podcasting voice.
Yeah. Our ASMR voice. Actually, I don't even What is ASMR? Alice says Shahid. More random.
Whoa. You just took the opportunity to say Alice Shahid and you didn't take it?
Oh my god. I'm the worst. I've ruined everything. Oh no.
Oh my gosh. ASMR Alice Shahid minus restrictions.
No, wait, I got it. Alice Shahid
Moxie.
No. Alice Shahid Malls Rosie. Malls.
Oh my gosh, poor Rosie.
Yeah, but like with love, you know, not like a normal.
Oh, with love.
Yeah, Alice Shahid Malls Rosie.
Maul cats with love.
Yeah. Speaking of Rosie, actually, sorry, podcast listeners, you can't see this, but Shahid, look, the bag I have my microphone stuff in is on the bed right now, and Rosie just like climbed into it. Can you see?
Oh my gosh, yeah, she is a microphone.
Yeah, she just like put herself in there. She's so cute. She's perfect. I love Rosie.
Alice Shahid, microphone Rosie.
Oh my god! Alice Shahid, microphone Rosie. We solved it. That's what ASMR is, and that's what this podcast is now.
The trio.
Mm-hmm.
the Holy Trinity. so, yeah. Okay, so we're... he had a low voice. Oh my gosh. So, around 14, the same time, he started studying piano with the organist at the church he was singing at. He had a natural talent for piano. His mom was like, even though she had studied for years, after like 6 months, he was like better than her, is that what she said. Like, so he learned, he was a fast learner. By the time he was 17, he was so good, he was actually accompanying dance classes. Also started studying ballet with a friend of the director of where he was accompanying, who was the instructor at Ithaca College.
Also
founded the Ithaca Ballet.
So he is a blooming musician. He's 17 and he's learning ballet?
Yeah, he's learning ballet. He has a beautiful voice. He's learning piano.
Wow, save some talent for the rest of us, Julius Eastman.
Seriously, so much talent. Oh my gosh, there's like some quote where they like talk about how he's like a triple threat, like in talent, because he's like a choreographer, dancer, and musician. Just
oh
like
my god, of
amazing. And also a story where he like just gets called to a dance rehearsal, like, last notice to sub, last minute, and just, like, reads a score for, like, just, they just give him a score of, like, a Poulenc thing, and he just, like, plays it.
I can't. Wow.
Yeah. So, okay, so he was studying ballet. So dance actually plays, and movement plays a big part in a lot of his compositions. Mm-hmm. So he has compositions for dancers as well. He was studying piano and went to Ithaca College for a year and went into, like, this intense program. And his teacher was like, you need to audition to a conservatory. So he auditioned to Juilliard, didn't make it. And then he went to Curtis and he did make it. Mm. And he basically answered on the application. There was a question that was like, what is your ultimate goal in studying music? And he was like, I would like to become an excellent musician and a pianist. Okay, so that's that. And we'll see that again in a minute. Oh, so at Curtis,
okay.
So he was studying piano, right? Oh. He was like one of two black students in the class. I think there was like somebody else. There's a transcript of somebody else talking about how she applied to Curtis and they wouldn't let her in because she was black. So the fact that he was in there is like pretty good, pretty cool. And it's like, I guess, predating like the serious like civil rights stuff that mm-hmm. was happening.
Yeah, this must have been when. So this was like early 60s then?
Right, so let's see. Oh gosh, I should have a year. So he graduated in 63. So right, it might have been early 60s, late 70s, probably. So yeah, he was one of two black students in his class. He lived at the YMCA. He mostly kept to himself. He was friends with a couple of Latina students that he knew. And they would like gig together, and there's like some cute stories of them being friends. But it was evident that like he didn't have the prior classical training that like the other students did at Curtis. So possibly that is why he was like shy. Maybe like he knew of this like difference in level. So after his first year, he wanted to switch to composition. And this time, his response to what is your ultimate goal in studying music was to obtain wisdom. So he is very, very spiritual, like super spiritual.
And
like I think even like anything that he's not spiritually attached to musically, I don't think he really like, there's a lot we'll get to it.
Okay.
So while he was at Curtis, he was dealing with health issues. He was underweight, he had a heart murmur, there was like family history of like bad health stuff, and yeah, not good. Music students, take care of yourselves, please. Mm-hmm. Please take care of yourselves. Yeah. But he graduated in 63, so he made it through. Mm-hmm. Went back home, studied at Ithaca some more. He auditioned into the Met Opera chorus and got in and then declined.
Oh, okay.
yeah, so he was just like, okay, well, better things await for him anyways. So
good for him.
I
want to be that bold and powerful to make it into the Met Opera and then be like, no, I can do better.
Alice, we'd like to officially accept you as our principal flutist for the LA Philharmonic.
Actually, no, I think I can do better than that. Sorry, thanks.
Okay, thanks, bye. So he was studying, he was like freelancing, doing like different performances and stuff. And eventually got recommended to Eugene Ormandy for a minor role in Der Rosenkavalier. He eventually starts composing for a director of dance at University of Buffalo. And through there, he meets a friend, Carl Singletary, who comes back into his life. They live together for a brief period. He was kind of hard to live with.
Oh, okay.
Eastman was. He was, like, very social, and, like, people would, like, be going over at, like, middle of the night, like, just, like, knocking on the door, like, lots of friends and stuff, I guess. So, but he was doing well. Like, he was touring in Europe. He was touring in the U.S. He actually got hired as a teaching assistant for the State University of New York, Buffalo, accompanying the dance program. And he was living in this, like, cute little artist town and making connections in Buffalo. And he ended up becoming a creative associate, which was, like, a huge program. So Buffalo was a big center for new music. The creative associate program was basically, like, we're going to pay you to live here and perform and write and do what you want and give you, like, performance venues. Just do your thing.
Okay.
So, so George Crumb and Terry Riley are some names of, like, people that went through this program.
Wow.
Obviously, like, a very, like, high legacy program.
Mm-hmm.
So this was, like, a really cool thing for him to do. And so this was in 1969. He also joined the SEM Ensemble, which was an ensemble focused on, like, improvisation and new music, that was nearby, that was started by a flutist there, a Czech flutist. And so after this this appointment with Creative Associates, he actually became an instructor at University of Buffalo. So he was teaching there, he was teaching theory. And so during this period, he had, like, financial stability. He was, like, amazing. He was doing so many amazing things. He was invited to sing under Zubin Mehta. He conducted one of his own pieces with the LA Phil. He played King George III in Davies' 8 Songs for Mad King with the New York Philharmonic under Boulez.
Wow.
Recorded it with the composer in London. And then it was nominated for a Grammy.
Wow.
So that is, like, he was very well known for this, like, role, kind of like Bach or something, where a composer was more known for their performing during their lifetime, and then after their lifetime it was, like, their compositions. He was so well known for his acting and singing, especially with that role, which, like, was incredible. Okay, so he was going through all this, but he wasn't really content. He, like, wanted to keep going. And so he started to get into jazz through, like, a University of Buffalo faculty colleague person. And his brother, Jerry, actually, so we haven't heard of him for a while.
Right.
You heard about him in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
So he, also incredible musician, was a jazz guitarist and bassist and played for Count Basie's band
for cool. a while. Oh, cool. Wow.
Yeah. So after he finished with that, he basically, Eastman had just bought a house in this, like, very white part of Buffalo that was very racist. He asked Jerry to, like, come and help him and also to, like, play with him because they wanted to, like, play some jazz together.
Oh, yeah.
Like I said, Eastman was starting to get into this. He had such a huge affinity for improv. Like, he was like, jazz and improv is, like, the true expression of the soul. Like, where classical music, you have to, like, structure it, and it's very, like, you know, not exactly immediate as, like, an improv would, an improvisation is.
Yeah.
So he had this connection, and also in the 70s, like, free jazz was starting to move into more of, like, an artsy space, like, where they were, like, you know, you would see free jazz performances, like, art galleries or something, instead of, like, a bar, right? Like, you would see it everywhere, but those boundaries started to break, and then classical music, or new music, I guess, started to go the other way as well, where it was, like, kind of breaking from that classical tradition.
Yeah, and so those, I remember, from when I was in the 70s.
Yeah, me too. Because we're vampires.
Yeah, and we look great for our age.
We do.
Did I tell you that at work the other day, this 17-year-old kid was like, so, are you, like, in high school? And I was like, no, I am not.
And I wish I was.
I don't wish I was in high school. Are you kidding me? I am glad those days are over.
Everyone, I've recently been starting to be called kid, like, a lot.
Really?
Like, by, yeah, like, by, I started playing again in like some like flute ensembles that I haven't played in a while, like SOA. And I'll like talk to the people there, and they'll just like call me kid, like not like a rude way, but I'm just like, yeah. Don't let me age anymore.
Oh my God.
I want to be young forever.
I want to be young forever, and I believe that I will, but also at the same time, like, I had a staff meeting party thing with my coworkers last night, and besides the manager and the owners, there's seven of us. I am the least white person there, which is an issue. I am one of two women, one of them will be leaving, and except for one of them, I'm the oldest, and I really felt it yesterday.
Whoa.
Yeah. People would just be talking about stuff, and, like, the energy would go a certain way, and I would realize, like, wow, I'm too old for this.
Whoa.
Yeah, I've never felt that way before, so I have to accept that I'm an adult now, whatever that means.
You are an adult.
I am an adult, and you can be my son, that way... I'll be whatever I am, and then you can be my son. I'll teach you how to ride a bike, like I promised several episodes ago.
I'm still waiting.
Yeah. Do you want to buy one of our bikes? Because we are selling them.
Oh my gosh, I should, but I have nowhere to put it.
Do you not have bike racks?
No.
Oh no, sad.
Somebody like leaves their bike in the parking spot in my parking garage, like where a car should be. Yeah, but there's no bike racks, so...
Huh, okay, well...
But I do want to learn.
Uh-huh.
I will take you up on that.
Okay.
I will, yeah.
Yay! Okay, anyway, tangent over. Where were we? We were, I have no idea.
We had just finished talking about his improv, love right. for improv and jazz.
Right.
And, okay, so we were just about to get to you. In the early 70s, so he was in the Creative Associates, he was composing and stuff. He wrote Stay On It, which is, I think it's the first track on Unjust Malaise, which we'll get back to later. But it's honestly one of my favorite pieces. It incorporates like pop elements into minimalism, and it has like really high energy, and it also like evolves into like this crazy improvisatory frenzy. One performance he did, I think he like played like a Supremes song like in the middle of it. So it's a really cool piece. But as the period continued of his life, he became increasingly distressed, like an unhappy, uncontent. He might've been feeling like pulled between the two worlds of like jazz and classical, also like being black in like a predominantly white field, like queer, like all of this stuff. Probably a lot of like internal like fighting going on. So he was like not happy with a lot of the stuff he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like stories of him just like getting up and leaving rehearsals in the middle of rehearsals, wow. refusing to learn music or like do things in the music instructions, and just like overall growing disenchanted with his career at University of Buffalo. So his contract actually ended and they decided not to renew it. So looking back into his 3-year contract as a teacher there, students complained that he like would just skip classes. He was like unorganized and like wouldn't tell anyone when he was going on tour, so they would just be like left with a teaching assistant without any so they knew like he's an amazing musician, he should be doing stuff in music but probably just like not teaching because he was unorganized. There might be like a part of like race which played into this.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, at this point, the faculty were more or less like on the left side, like as far as progressiveness goes, mm-hmm. In race and diversity. So who can say? All we have is that those like I guess assessments from the students that said, yeah, he just like didn't show up sometimes and was unorganized. But he saw this kind of as like just like money, and he didn't really like that mm-hmm. anyways. It's like, if we're just doing this for the money, like, there's no point. There's no, it's not good.
Yeah.
So one of the last things he did, we're about to get into a very controversial thing that he did.
Ooh.
What is first, like, pissing people off thing.
Okay.
So he performed, they had performed the ensemble he was in, Cage's Songbooks. Mm. And so John Cage's songbooks are like a giant, like, instruction manuals on like things to do in a performance. And they're meant to be like, by the time you get on stage, you're not really knowing what else is happening on stage. You're just like doing your set instruction. So okay. the performance that happens in real time is like, you don't know. It's like almost improvised, but it's not improvised. You know mm-hmm. what I mean?
Yeah.
So they had performed this before, and Cage loved it and was like really happy with their performance, and complimented it. So they did it again for this music festival, that was put on. And, this time Julius Eastman decided to like put together a lecture on how to have sex. And so his instruction was something like, do something disciplined or something like that. And he decided, well, this is discipline. I'm going to give a lecture on how to have sex.
Wow. Okay.
And so he like stripped down a guy on stage, like naked, and was just like very like sexual and talking.
Oh.
So obviously Cage was pissed, because... Okay, so let's talk about this. So they're from two different generations, right?
Right.
Cage and Eastman. Cage was older than Eastman, and Eastman was in a different, like, sort of generation as far as queerness goes.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also black. He wasn't white like Cage was. So there's a lot of context going into this, as well as what we talked about before with, like, having absolutely no filter.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah.
So Cage was really angry, and he was like thinking that it was like insensitively interpreted, and he didn't understand because they did such a great job before, apparently. But for Eastman, this was like no different than any of the other performances. It was just like, what's the matter? Mm. What's wrong?
Yeah.
Like, this is what yeah. it says to do. So
I did what you told me to do.
Right. And it's so open-ended. So it's kind of like, you made this piece open-ended, and then you got mad that something happened that you didn't want to happen, but you didn't say it shouldn't happen. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's like already intentionally like vague. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. And there's this dichotomy of, like I said, the generations where Cage, who, you know, his sexuality was concealed.
Yeah.
And it was like different for him, and the sexuality wasn't necessarily something that they would put at the forefront of their music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Eastman did, you know.
Yeah.
He was very upfront about his sexuality. And he also, there was like an interview where he was like, love comes first. Like, love is better, and then music. Music is second.
Mm-hmm.
So like, this is like, it makes sense.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It makes yeah. sense. But yeah, so Cage was very angry. So that was the songbooks controversy. So this is a quote just before he left Buffalo. That is a quote that I think everyone is, this is like a one of his most famous quotes.
Mm-hmm.
What I am trying to achieve is to be what I am to the fullest. Black to the fullest, a musician to the fullest, a homosexual to the fullest. It is through art that I can search for the self and keep in touch with my resource and the real me.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's nice.
So, yeah. So after this, he was playing jazz and stuff, which was awesome for him. And he was really enjoying that. But after the Buffalo thing, he was like, I'm going to leave to New York City. I think that, you know, Buffalo is too limited of a place for me. And other people thought so too, after having talked to him and met him and said, you know, this area, like, you need a bigger like place to do what you need to do.
Yeah.
Buffalo, so, you know, like New York. So he just ups and goes to New York City. Like, no job in mind or anything, yes, just yet.
Oh my God.
He moved in with his grandmother.
Aww.
So if you remember, he was, the grandmother was living in New York when he first got that piano book. So she, I think she owned an apartment building.
Oh, so, cool.
Yeah. So he was living there and was working, thanks to a connection that he had through Buffalo, with the Brooklyn Philharmonia, and was able to do like concerts and conduct and compose for like ensembles and play and solo. So he was still doing music work, thankfully.
Yeah.
And he started to like become increasingly antagonizing. So we talked about this before in Buffalo, where he just like was starting to become unreliable. Like, he wouldn't show up for things. Like, maybe an event that promoted him, it was like all for him, and like he just like wouldn't show up.
Oh my God.
Or just like show up to rehearsals like drunk or something, or just like not really committing to those things. For reasons unknown to us, right? So yeah, so he was becoming increasingly unreliable, harder to work with. I think people started to like distance themselves from him because of his like personality, and how he was starting to become. And he was losing work. He started to live around with different people in Manhattan, like various lovers. And, you know, lost the Brooklyn. He like left the Brooklyn Philharmonia job. And from there on, it was starting to like fall apart, and we lose where his life goes exactly. Like, we start to lose track of what's happening in the last couple of years of his life. But it started to fall apart. So he lost his apartment. This is where, like, I think his brother said, like, this is where I knew something was wrong with him, like, mentally, because he lost his apartment from, he was getting evicted. He couldn't pay. The police escorted him out and took all of his scores and stuff, like all of his work. And he didn't care. He was just like, oh, I don't need that stuff. Like, just like, he didn't try to get it back.
Wow.
Yeah. And so he, like I said, it was harder to keep track of him. And there's different accounts of people running into him and him trying to contact other people. And was living in homeless shelters. There were rumors that he was doing drugs, lots of alcohol. And there was a period in the 80s which he tried to turn his life around. I think he was like working with like a psychiatrist and like applied for a job and got a job, but he just like disappeared after a while. And so his friend Singletary saw him just like a week or two or something like that before he passed away on May 28th, 1990. He was 49 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. So a lot of people parallel his life to a jazz musician's life, even though he was classically trained and had like a very classical career, in that he was like someone who was energetic and like a genius and like had so many amazing ideas, and then like succumbed to like drug alcohol abuse and then died young.
Yeah
So his music like just kind of fell off the face of the earth until one of his friends, Mary Jane Leach, who is a composer, she's not a musicologist, and was just friends with him, decided to like uncover and spent years and years like uncovering his work and putting together a biography, which is what I was reading for this episode, which I will mention at the end of the episode. So his music did make a revival and is making a revival, but there's a lot of controversies with some of his music.
Really?
So let's get into his music.
Okay, yes, let's.
Let's do it.
Yes.
So just a quick content warning. I will be referring to a racial slur. I won't be using the racial slur. But there is a heavy connotation that comes with the word, So that is my content warning. Okay. Let's talk about the use of the N-word. I personally am not going to use it because I'm not black. And it is important to know the context of which he did use it in his own pieces. So as we know, he faced backlash a lot of the time from his controversies, even from like black communities. So a specific instance where he performed three of his pieces, which we're going to talk about, there was backlash from like black students and faculty who basically censored the titles of the pieces and didn't allow the titles to be printed on the program. So he, before this concert, he explains, he uses the N-word kind of as like a powerful word with like 52 subtypes, and he kind of compares it to Allah, which has 99 names.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So he's kind of like reclaiming the word in like a power positionality.
Mm-hmm.
And he states that the first N-word is the basis of like which America's economy, like the entire economy, is built off of.
So that's, man, like a powerful image. Okay.
Right. And so the trope of, so one of his pieces is called the crazy N-word. And the trope of that, of the idea of crazy N-word, would have been accessible to Eastman, and was used even by Malcolm X in a speech in the 60s, basically meaning like a radical, like someone who is fighting for freedom and fighting for change, and might have been seen like as someone who's crazy, like they're calling them crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But it was someone who was actively like trying to fight the system to get their freedom.
Mm.
So mm-hmm. instead of being like subservient to, you know, what white people would have wanted. So he also reclaims faggot in the title of one of his works.
Mm.
So he is using a lot of these words, which are very controversial to people. So, yeah. And they spark conversations. They spark conversations because even today, like, me right now saying I'm not going to say the title of this work, right? Mm-hmm. It's like such a controversy to both sides of the coin. Like, am I censoring his work? Am I like kind of hiding the true impact and meaning of it? But at the same time, in today's society, like, I should not be saying that word at all, because there are people who would try any way to find a like excuse to be able to say the word,
right? Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, it's a really tight thing. So this is what I was talking about, the trickster, is that someone was talking about this, like, he's probably, like, cackling right now at us, like, trying to maneuver this. So it makes people uncomfortable today and mm-hmm. sparks conversations, which I think is a really important part, because that's literally his identity. Like, yeah. All of these things is his experience, you know, as a black queer man in the classical music world.
Yeah.
So if anything, I think the fact that it's so relevant today and controversial today can speak to the immense amount of work we still have to do in fighting racism.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah, lots of work to be done.
Do you think that, like, if he was around today, like, if he was doing all of his work and stuff today, would it have been received any differently, do you think?
I think so. I think the idea of reclaiming the word... gangster rap, right, which mm-hmm. like used the word, didn't come until later. So the Northwestern, like, in the academic circles, the mere thought of like reclaiming a word for its power like that was not even thought of, like, in new music circles at all. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, oh, how you're using this word, like reclaiming, you know, just kind of something that hadn't really been introduced into that field yet. So he was kind of like igniting that fire.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
I think today, I think maybe we're a little bit more accustomed to like reclaiming a slur.
Yeah. There's lots of, you know, gay words that have been reclaimed, like queer, dyke. The gay F slur is debatable. I feel like there's a small population of queer people who are like, oh, I will reclaim it, and the rest who are like, maybe I won't, but cool. Do you know what the vagina monologues are?
Yes, I do. I've heard of them.
I saw the vagina monologues at CSUN. And so for those of you who don't know what it is, the vagina monologues, it's like kind of like a play, but it's not a play. It's just a series of monologues that like take turns, like they're, they cut between each other and it's live on a stage. And each monologue is about some, usually a woman. I think the vagina monologues are all women, but maybe they're being updated to include just anybody with vaginas. But you know, these women who have these, experiences with their vaginas and like the social, emotional, physical, like circumstances that come from that. Mm-hmm. And there was this, I saw it at CSUN, and there was this really powerful one that I remember so distinctively, and it was about reclaiming the word cunt. And, so that's a word where in like Australia, apparently people will throw that word around like nothing, like nobody even cares. But here in America, it's like one of those words that's like, whoa, okay, that's a strong word, you know? but the monologue was all about like, you know, just like reclaiming the word, because it's like, it's a, the word itself is hard and punchy, you know?
Right.
And they're like, well, a vagina is like the strongest thing there is.
Right.
Yeah, and so they're talking about that. But the coolest thing about it is that the actress who was doing the monologue, she was deaf. So she was signing her whole monologue while a like a voiceover would read the monologue for her. And that was like amazing. And then at the end of the monologue, she was like, "Okay, everybody, let's start chanting the word cunt." And so the whole audience started like yelling cunt. Cunt! And she started yelling it too, and she hadn't spoken like out loud the whole time. It was just like amazing. Wow. Yeah, I saw that like, you know, 6 years ago, and I still think about it constantly.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, it was super powerful. Anyway, I love reclaiming words. I love the idea about it. I love
Me too.
I love talking about it and thinking about it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I love the word faggot, mostly like because okay. I've had it used, like, violently against me. Like, mm-hmm. I think I've talked about maybe in a past episode that one of, when I was growing up, a house I had was living in vandalized. Like, someone graffitied my
house. Yeah, yeah.
So it carries, like, some weight, but more than anything, I think I've used and heard the word more between, like, queer friends who are just, like, mockingly, like, making fun of like bullies. So we'll be like, "Hey, you faggot!" Like, we'll just make fun of each other.
Oh my god!
Which is like, so I don't know. I think it's hilarious. Like, it's top tier like queer comedy to me.
Yeah.
But reclaiming it, yeah. I don't think I've personally used it in that way, like using that power and shifting it.
Yeah.
So it's a really, it is a really powerful thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Okay. So he uses these words in his own context. And he also, has this concept of organic music. So organic music is something that like, I guess grows and changes over time. And the way he describes it is that there's like three parts, and the first two parts, all the material from the first two parts are present in the third part.
Okay.
So whether that be like a smaller cell or a bigger like structure, it's just that the first two parts are present in the third.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be seen in some of his earlier pieces, like Feminine, which I'm not going to talk about today, but I highly recommend you check out. Mm. But we're going to focus on today, which is the N-word series. Evil N-word, crazy N-word, and gay gorilla. That is GUERILLA.
Mm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So all of these are scored for any multiple instruments from the same family. So for example, like a string orchestra or woodwinds. The recording that I'm referencing is on Unjust Malaise, where he's performing in. And so it's, I think it's like four pianos.
Mm.
So let's start with Gay Gorilla. So GUERILLA.
Uh-huh.
It begins really soft, and it has like this really beautiful harmonies that kind of evolve. So remember this, it's all of this is organic music, and it's all minimalist music. So it's very repetitive, but it does go somewhere. It has like this kind of like a journey, which is really gorgeous. So his reason for Gay Gorilla, like the reason he called it this, he states in his talk. So, okay, wait, before I say, yeah, so all of this is like his identity, right? Mm-hmm. His experience. So he states in his talk that there aren't many gay gorillas or people in the community that would like die for what they believe in. And so the hopes for this piece was that he would become one, like somebody who would die for what he believed in.
Oh, okay.
So totally like, just reminds me of the Cage incident, right? Like mm-hmm. someone who kind of hides behind it rather than puts it at the forefront.
Yeah.
So Evil N-Word is a really intense piece. It has like really rapid movement on the piano and it's very repetitive. And it evolves into like this multi-tonal, like complex sound. Mm. In the recording on Unjust Malaise, you can hear Eastman's voice calling out like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then like it'll return to the like this introductory thing, and then it continues to evolve into like this very complex like amalgamation of this rhythm.
Wow.
Towards the end, it like suddenly stops, and you just like hear a bass note ringing. And then there's like it starts to decay and you hear like single notes on the piano just like mm-hmm. ringing out like slowly. Mm. That one is really good. Highly recommend. And the last one, Crazy N-Word, is about an hour long. It's like twice as long as the last two.
Oh, my God.
So for this one, I decided to pull a quote. Composed in 1978. Crazy N-Word offers a muscular parallel to the more mannered minimalism of the era. His key attacks in powerful flurries right from the start, cascading complex harmonies that arguably feel more immediate, gloriously voluminous, and heck, crazed than work by almost any of his contemporaries. By the track's hammering climax and lofted conclusion, first-time listeners will be under little illusion as to the thrilling power of Eastman's playing and vision. So I think I said, I might have mentioned this at the beginning, but comparing him to like the other minimalist composers of the time who feel very, at least in my opinion, when I listen to them, a lot more reserved and like kind of like boxed into like a structure. Mm-hmm. This is like, this music feels like it is not boxed in. And I think even the titles speak to how he does not want to be boxed into this. So very powerful. It's really powerful music. So those are the three. The other piece that I mentioned before was Stay On It, which is so good. It was stuck in my head like this entire weekend. Mm-hmm. My recommendation is, I guess we're at the recommendations now. So check out Unjust Malaise, which I found on Spotify. Stay On It is on there. He's performing. I think it has like a flute, piano. So it always has a pianist, percussionist, and vocalist, and then like any other instrumentalists. And it has this like really, really catchy like motif that repeats over and over again and then brings in improv. And then like towards the end of this recording, like just turns into this like craziness and like sirens and like and then it just like returns back to the, oh my gosh, I love it so much. It's a really, really good performance, and I was taken away. It's about a half hour long. I super recommend it. So all of those and the ones I was talking about before are on Unjust Malaise. The last track of Unjust Malaise is him talking about the three pieces from the N-Word series that we talked about today. So you can hear him explain himself in his own words. Check out Mary Jane Leach's and Renee Levine Packer's book, Gay Gorilla, Julius Eastman and His Music. Also, check out Unjust Malaise, which I have been talking about, which features also some amazing works I have not even mentioned, like The Holy Presence of Joan d'Arc for 10 cellos.
Ooh.
So really good stuff in there. And if you can also find feminine, do that. almost all of my information has been taken from this book. It's really, really amazing. Mary Jane Leach wrote the biography in this book for him that is really in depth and absolutely incredible. So I highly recommend you check that out. Also check out some of her music too, because she's also a female composer.
Yeah. Right. Wow. That was amazing. He sounded like a really fascinating, like what would it be like to talk to him, you know?
Yeah. I really like reading in the book, like, the accounts of, so Mary Jane Leach has one account of, like, when he stopped by, and there's, like, an account of, like, them talking and, like, what he was like, and the personality comes through the pages, like,
yeah,
you know, it's so incredible. And also when you can hear him talk in the album, it's also really cool.
Yeah. Oh man, that's amazing. I don't think I have any words that could do him justice.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, that was great. And
totally, like, I guess the last thing to leave everybody with is, why is it that his music is so often, like, concealed, right? Like, how I hadn't heard of him until somebody had mentioned him to me. So probably not as concealed in new music circles, but at least to me, I hadn't heard of him until this.
Yeah.
So his music, you know, controversial or not, deserves to not be censored or, like, hidden away from everybody, right?
Mm. Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's depth of meaning that should be carried through. I think that we should continue his legacy.
Absolutely. Wow. I think, you know what we can do is we can post links to, like, all of his works and stuff in our podcast notes and stuff and on social media and whatever, so that way we're not just being like, look at us talk about Julius Eastman. We can just, like, pass it along to his actual stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. Wow. What an amazing person.
Yeah. Incredible. I love that he just, like, was himself in the face of, you know, people, an entire field that wasn't like him.
Yeah.
Like, he was not afraid to just be himself. He was so himself.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's, like, everything that I aspire to be, truly.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Wow. Well, on that note, I suppose we'll end today. Happy Pride, everybody.
Happy Pride. Ooh. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Yeah, and go be yourself, like Julius Eastman would want you to do.
Go be yourself.
Yeah.
And also forever.
Yeah. Goodbye.